I'd like to welcome everybody to the War College here at CelestiCon in 2013. This is the last talk on Sunday, and Jack Green, who is one of our special guests, author, game designer, is going to talk about World War I battleships and reassessing them. Jack has got at least one game that includes World War I battleships, right? Fleet Admiral, is that right? And so you're going to be talking about how everything we've ever done and everybody has done is absolutely wrong. And we have two Jutland games here. One is the Avalon Hill Classic, right?
Mm-hmm. And the other one's Avalanche.
And the Avalanche is the other one. Okay. Well, without further ado, Jack, please.
So, I gave this talk at Consum World, and there was a German magazine editor in the audience, game magazine, and he asked a couple questions, and it was a good talk, and everything went fine. And I basically said that every naval war game on World War I is crap, including my fleet out. And the next morning, I went down to breakfast, and he happened to be there, and I sat down next to him, and I started talking with him, and he goes, "You know, Chuck, you're the only game designer I've ever met who said his game design is shit." It was kind of, I actually enjoyed the remark. So I did Fleet Admiral, which was an amateur-produced game in 1989. And as so often, and of course, these people are famous for it, you try to have every freaking battleship that was ever even thought about by every nationality on the planet, okay? And what I realized in doing a bunch of research this spring and rereading Marder, reading Sumida, reading Brooks, who is a challenger of Sumida's views on fire control, and some contemporary books, I came to the conclusion that we've got it all wrong. What we have done consistently over the years is we've taken the number of guns, the weight of the shell, and the rate of the fire, and voila, we have a gunfire factor. Okay? Is it pretty accurate, Mark?
Jack, you said Sumida.
Who's John Sumida? Okay. He wrote In Defense of Naval Supremacy. He's an expert on fire control. He edited the Poland Papers. The two chief fire...
What's his name?
Pardon?
Could you spell
S-U-M-I-D-A.
I-D-A?
I-D-A. He is still a professor at the University of Maryland.
Yes.
And actually was a schoolmate of Tom at the Banat Sled School.
When did he have this book that he wrote?
He came out during Reagan. He's one of the very few people who write military history books who sells a lot. Because one of the main keys in his book, with Reagan in power especially, is that the British built up their navy before World War I by taxing the rich. And Reagan built up the navy by going into debt. And it was one of those books on history that caught the political scene in Washington, D.C. And it may have helped the fact that he was at the Maryland at the time. I don't know. But it actually sold pretty well. And if you go online and try to buy a used copy of it, it's a pricey book.
And the reason you say you read this book and it started you rethinking, is that what you're saying?
I read him a long time ago. And he, basically there's two fire control systems that are available to the British. One is the Dreyer system, which is one that's more or less universally adopted within their Navy, okay? Now, the Poland system, which actually used a rudimentary computer, it was in some considered to be one of the first computers.
Analog computer.
And he, Sumida argues that the Poland system should have been adopted, not the Dreyer system. Poland was a civilian. Dreyer was a captain in the British Navy. There was discussions over money. There was an element of plagiarism. Poland later sued the British Admiralty, and he won in court. for some. But for example, in this game, and this I just kind of understood it when I did Fleet Admiral. Benigoff, John Benigoff, who's the Michael Benigoff. He has like the Queen Mary has a plus one on its gunnery because it had a polling system installed on the Queen Mary, which is not the passenger ship, but the battlecruiser. Okay,
that's the Avalanche version of Java.
Exactly correct. Okay, of course it's not even, and this isn't even coming into play in Avalon Hills game. Okay, and by the way, I just signed a contract with John Krantz to bring out Fleet Admiral 2 Jutland, and hopefully by 2016. And whereas when I did the original Fleet Admiral, it went from 1912 to 1922, and I made the same sin as Avalanche. Yet every battleship ever designed put in the game, mine's going to be a rifle shot, not a shot metal. And that rifle shot's going to be 1914 to 1916. Because the Battle of Jutland changes everything. It's a watershed event, especially for the British. Okay. And you could make a good argument that it's the largest battle ever fought. People will say Leyte was bigger. You know, whatever. It's certainly big. And I want to make 3 points today. I would suggest all battleship games of this period are heavily flawed, including my own game. And I will outline some of the things that need to be done. We have to more fully address the rapid improvement of warships. And I think that is one of the key things that really came home to me, and I'll get to that in a second here, where I came up with this. That we've kind of thought, well, this is the dreadnought, and you have a diagram of the dreadnought. And then here's the Lion, and here's the Queen Elizabeth class, the warship. I would argue that it's Dreadnought, Lion, and warship. And there's several reasons for this.
You mean that they are...
It's a quantum change in improvement.
Many times, not just a little bit, but a big jump. Between those three, huge
right.
jump.
In other words, the technological change is so rapid in this period, and the values of the ships are not balanced the way they should be.
Okay.
In other words, the Queen Elizabeth is a quantum leap ahead of the Dreadnought. And if you think about it, the British had some sense of this. Guess where the Dreadnought was at the time of Jutland? It was down south as the flagship of their most modern, second most modern pre-dreadnoughts, older battleships. It had already been...
Jeff saying that the dreadnought was an incredible advance over pre-dreadnoughts, but the Queen Elizabeth was an incredible advance over the early...
Exactly correct, and we will get to that. So, I'm going to talk about battleship design, role of range finding, and the quantity fleet that Germany built, not the quality fleet. That's another key point. One of the most interesting personalities, and a treat to read for nothing else, is his explosive use of the English language. It is First Sea Lord Admiral John Jacky Fisher. He is the inventor of the Dreadnought. I finally got all three volumes of his letters, and I'm in the third volume finally. He invented the Dreadnought battleship with the launching in 1906 of the Dreadnought, and its record completion within 2 years of being laid down. And this was probably the best known of his five great reforms that he began instituting in 1904. Now, naval war games, such as this one, have made this break well known. For example, the Russian Borodino and the Japanese Mikasa in Avalanche games have their main armor mode of 2 12-inch guns fore, 2 12-inch aft, and turrets as three factors. Well, I would argue... They're right there from, you've got a mistake. The Japanese should probably be four and the Russians three, just based on training and doctrine and technology.
And also the height of the guns above the waterline. The height of the main battery above the waterline.
Sure, that could be done in Agari too. But here's a quote that got my attention. In 1910, August 22, to the First Lord of the Admiralty, Reginald McKenna, four years before the outbreak of World War I, Fisher wrote, "The Lion is superior to the Dreadnought, is the Dreadnought to all before her," which would be like the Borodino or the Mikasa. And your coming motor battleship, which was the Queen Elizabeth class, as superior to the Lion as the Lion is to the Dreadnought. And that's where my brain started to wrap around it. Now, Fisher's point was that the Dreadnought could bring to bear on a broadside 8 12-inch rifles, firing a shell that was about 850 pounds. Getting back to my whole thing I said at the beginning, rate of fire, weight of shell, gunfire factor. Now, this compared to the foreign Mikasa, the Connecticut, or the Borodino. Plus, in Fisher's fevered vision, the extra speed of the Dreadnought, 3 knots, gave it a tactical advantage over the old pre-Dreadnought designs because he could choose the range to fight the battle at. And that, Fisher, in my opinion, put too much emphasis on speed. And I think the best example is some of the battle cruisers. And that they just were not as, they needed more armor, they needed a little bit better protection. Now, the Lion could also bring 8 guns on a broadside, but they were 13.5-inch shells firing 1,250-pound shell, and later that was increased to a 1,400-pound shell, okay? Plus, it could touch 30 knots for speed, which is a hell of a lot faster than 21. And now, this brings me to the second point. So, well, we've talked about pretty much the rate of fire and how that affects, but as I got into this, I started to put more into it. So, for example, the British had poor shells that were not corrected until after the Battle of Jutland. A lot of their shells were duds. The Germans had a few duds, too. Don't think that the Germans were perfect. But in comparison, the British had a real fundamental problem with their shells. They weren't properly tested before the war, and it wasn't until the Battle of Jutland that they realized they had a problem they really needed to correct. Okay? Now, Martyr argues, and I suspect he's close to the mark, that by early 1918, after these reforms came in after the Battle of Jutland, that the Grand Fleet was 100% improved. This is the number he uses. And we'll get back to it a little bit later in this, as some of these improvements were. But it was, you know, tactical changes, shell improvement. One of the reasons I decided I had to do a rifle shot limiting it to 1914-1916 is that, my God, I'd have a hell of a lot more roster sheets if I did 1917-1918, the expansion version.
I also think fleet signals are significantly improved.
Oh, but we'll get to that. The British introduced the radio. Okay, a second point. The British 12-inch guns were not as good as their 13.5s. One of the things, for example, they had a higher spread. So when you fired a broadside, your spread was wider with the 12-inch. It was narrower with the 13.5, and it was even more narrow with the 15-inch. And then, for example, I found a little nugget. It turns out the Warder class of armored cruisers were one of the most stable gun platforms that the British built. So what I decided, you know, when I have these armored cruisers and this happens to be a warrior, you give them a little bit of the benefit. And what happens with this old guys? Well, excuse me there. we want, I think, to have less pluses and minuses, less guy die rolling, less going to this table or that table. What we want to do is have a set number. So what I'm envisioning for Fleet Admiral is that, say, a Dreadnought-style battleship, say the Benbow or the Bellerophon would be a good example. Some of the early ones is that because they have 12-inch guns, actually Benbow might have been 13.5, but 12-inch guns, you make them have a smaller gunfire factor. So you factor in all this crap so you don't have to mess with, well, it's plus one for this or minus one for that, and just make it easy. Now, there's going to be a couple situations where you can't avoid having that type of situation, where you have to make some modification. And the same thing goes that with the Queen Elizabeth, instead of just, going back to weight of shell, rate of fire, number of guns, you up the number to reflect its superior fire control and superior technology and superior electrics, and we'll get into that. So, now another thing that I came across... to finish this point up, I will factor down the British 12-inch guns and I will factor up the British 13.5-inch gun because it was a much better gun qualitatively than the 12-inch. Now, there's a whole thing about lighter guns were not as important against enemy capital ships, but the idea of a hail of fire still persisted. So, for example, Germans used 5.9 as their secondary armament for most of their warships. Some of the earlier pre-dreadnoughts had 6.7 for secondary guns. And they actually scored a fair number of hits at the Battle of Jutland, especially during the battle cruiser action. Virtually had no impact. They would have had an impact at shorter range, and we'll get into that. And according to Campbell wrote basically what every shell did at the Battle of Jutland, he tried to document. Okay, I can't remember the exact title of it, but I read that this
morning. Jutland, Colon, Analysis of the Fire.
Yep, that's correct. He claims that only one German battleship was actually penetrated by a British shell, and it was a 15-inch shell from the battleship Revenge. Now, the point that I will make, and I will continue to make, is that any capital ship that's hit by 20 heavy caliber rounds was essentially out of action, if not sunk. I mean, it may not be penetrating, but it's taking such a pounding that guns are falling out of action, turrets are getting jammed,
fires.
They're just general desolation.
Jack, just to make sure, Campbell, this is a new book?
It came out 20 years ago.
Okay. Yes. And it's called Jutland, Colon, An Analysis of a Battle?
Of the Fighting.
Of the Fighting.
That's
okay. Analysis of the Fighting.
Yeah. And Campbell also did a series of articles that appear in the yearly publication Warship.
Okay.
On the Russo-Japanese War as well. So there's continuity. He's since passed.
Campbell's first name?
Oh, he goes by the initials, like NJM or something like that. Not off the top of my head, no. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the spread. Okay, now here's the other thing. Yeah, you have to throw in the season. So when did the Battle of Jutland take place? May 31st, June 1st. Okay, so essentially, for all intents and purposes, the beginning of summer. The average range in the North Sea 7 out of 10 days is 8,000 yards. Battle of Jutland started basically at ranges of 18, 19, 17,000 yards. So the Germans actually ended up coming out in not their ideal fighting situation. Because the Germans, and one of the reasons the Germans were happy with smaller caliber guns, one of the reasons, was that they figured most of these actions are going, we're going to fight these guys maybe 5,000 yards, 7,000 yards, almost like a night action. It's going to be so damn close, we'll just pummel them with our 5.9s, our 9.4s, our 11-inch guns, our 12-inch guns, and we can, you know, penetrate their arm in a lot of cases, and the hail fire will work. And frankly, the Germans probably should have done that if they wanted to have success in a naval battle in World War I. Now, I came across this quote in Jutland 1916 by Nigel Steele and Peter Hart, 2003. Ironically, the Germans' reluctance to expose their precious dreadnoughts in the opening months of the war robbed them of their only realistic chance for a true naval victory. I will have an early 1915 scenario in the game where the Germans come out and I'll rig it in such a way so there's the potential of having something like a 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 yard range or visibility in the course of the day, and you as the game player can decide what might have happened. They would have sorted with two squadrons of pre-dreadnoughts, which were definitely second cabin. But on a short range day, say 8,000 yards, that could have contributed to a major naval action. Now the role of the director, key to finding range finding equipment, would be included in this game and really sets apart the British and German navies from most other navies. They were constantly improving their ability to fire accurately long range in 1905 to 1916 period. Now, in August of 1914, the British had the Thunderer, the Ajax, and six other ships equipped with modern fire control equipment. By the time of Jutland, the Bellerophon, the Agincourt, and the Arrow were the ones that lacked it. Two German dreadnoughts at the Battle of Jutland lacked modern fire control directors. Okay?
So three British and two German.
Yep. All navies carry some form of fire range-finding equipment. But I would argue there's about four or five levels. And we're talking about, with the British and the Germans at this point, probably level 3, level 4, and level 5. And I'll get into that. A new approved level could not simply be mass-produced and retrofitted onto older warships. And in part, this was due to the increasing use of electrical equipment, somewhat analogous to working in an older building. And I don't know, any of you guys ever worked in construction? That's what I did for years. And one of the things is, if you want to upgrade with modern electronics in an older building, it's a pain in the butt, because the building's not set up. It didn't anticipate when it was built in 1940 or 1960, or say the 1906 or 1907 battleship isn't ready to have all this new electronic equipment that's required for the fire control system and all the various lines and connections and communications that are needed. And so that's another reason that why the older ships become more obsolete quicker, while the newer ships are also the ones that are getting the new equipment. And this is, I think, another important part that we've forgotten, or we're maybe not aware of when we designed some of the games here. Almost the latest equipment is put on the newest warships. This simply increased the power of a new battleship over an older and less advanced dreadnought. So counting guns, weight of shell, rates of fire, as we've done in the past, just does not go far enough. Now, the German system, used in an embryonic and earlier form by the Italians, Austrians, and the United States Navy, I would say were superior to the British system. And you could argue that the British adopted the German system by the time World War II came about. Essentially, the Germans could use their rangefinders at 20,000 yards, where the British were good starting at about 16,000 yards. Now, as an exception are the British 15-inch battleships, which is the Queen Elizabeth class, and the first of the Resolution class, which were just arriving with the Grand Fleet when the Battle of Jutland took place. German rangefinders were better if the target was difficult to see, say due to smoke. And this is in large part to the use of wide rangefinders, 6 to 9 meters. So the Germans are actually using wider rangefinders than the British, but the British had adopted their newest and latest and widest on the Warspite class and their 15-inch battleships. So essentially, you have a 29-foot long rangefinders on the German best ships versus 15 feet in the Queen Elizabeth class or the other 15-inch battleships. The German practice in particular, but British too, was once the range was found, the target was being straddled, you went to rapid fire. Now, this is a quote from George von Haas, who was on board the Der Flinger. He later wrote, as a fire control officer, "Now I found the target. The transmitting station was to give the order, salvos fire to the heavy guns once every 20 seconds. While the firing was going on, any observation was out of the question. Naturally, such furious rapid fire could only be maintained for a limited time. It was not before our salvos fall over or short as a result of the enemy altering course. Each salvo was then directed afresh, attempting to straddle, and this continued until the target was again straddled. And then the devil's concert began again on the order. Good! Rapid fire!" So, one of the things I'm going to do in the game is, when you hit an enemy ship, you will get a marker that the target is acquired by whoever did the fire. And within a turn or two, each turn is going to be 6 minutes, the odds are that ship's going to be able to, the target ship is going to be able to change range, or you won't get the right die roll, hopefully, and so that you would lose that acquired target. So the point is that the process of acquiring a target with modern range finding equipment at long range is sort of like a methodical process, and once you acquired it, you pounded on it as best you could and as quickly as you could.
Jack, I don't know if you recall this, but one of our miniatures game, that's exactly what I did. I was firing, whoop, 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 but as soon as I got on target, bam, everybody fired at the same range, and that's how I knocked out one of your rocket ships.
Yeah, very well be.
The game I played yesterday over at PacificCon, Germans versus Americans, slightly post-World War I, was the same way. Once you found it, you doubled your die rolls.
Yeah, that's well. That's good. That's a good way.
If you lost it, then you're out of.
Sarah,
out
of luck.
What can I say?
I was not there, but I would argue that. I mean, it's, all this kind of stuff is in the literature. You just have to read it. Oh, as an aside, I don't think we need to concern ourselves in World War I game with ammunition. And Jutland, this is again. If it's not important, don't put it on the roster sheet. Eliminate it because it's just garbage. It's just something extra to worry about. And again, if it was a strategic game, you're at the Dardanelles, and you're worried about the Turks running out of ammunition, sure, it makes perfectly good sense. But essentially, no battleship that I know of in either war ran out of ammunition. I mean, there was a couple of them that got pretty low. I think the battle up in the Aleutians in World War II, there was a daylight
action.
Exactly. They got close. But now, let's go to the post-Jutland situation. Captain, later Admiral Chatfield, who was Beatty's flag officer on the battle cruisers, and then when Jellicoe went to the Admiralty, Beatty got kicked upstairs to be commander of the Grand Fleet, the big kahuna, and Chatfield went with him. Now, he was one of the first leaders in 1916 to call for improved shell and also for gunnery reform. A meeting endorsed by Admiral Beatty of the gunnery commanders and the flag officers of each squadron met. Chatfield wanted the ability of warships in action to concentrate their fire primarily on the enemy's van. And that was one of the reasons the Queen Elizabeths were built in the first place, is they were supposed to act as an independent squadron operating at the front of the column of the British battle fleet so that they could maneuver in with their higher speed and maybe concentrate additional gunfire on the van of the German fleet. To do so, he wanted to, one, if we have 10 ships in range, let us concentrate fire on 5 enemy warships. Two, rely on radio communication between warships, and this was suggested by Admiral Somerville, captain, I think. He might have been a commander, but Somerville was later the commander for most of the war of Force H at Gibraltar in World War II. And then he made this insight. The movement of the ship, the vibration, the reduced visibility due to smoke and spray, all made not only finding the initial range, but will more, keeping on target once the range was determined, a matter of utmost difficulty. Okay. The third point I want to talk about has to do with warships and their design and the Germans, and what the Germans wanted to do with their Navy. Now, I don't have the title. His name is Ivo Lambi, I-V-O Lambi, L-A-M-B-I. And if I'm not mistaken, he's a Scandinavian sociology professor, but he wrote a book on the German Navy and the German Navy's relationship with Scandinavia. From World War I to World War II. Now, one of the points that was, and I really hadn't thought about it, because we all think of the German quality. I mean, German quality ships, they're harder to sink, thicker armor, the guns, you know, that's always an argument. Well, Tirpitz was building a quantity fleet. He figured with smaller dreadnoughts, he could get more of them. They had lesser speed, smaller guns, and less range. He could build more of them. And one of his whole things was to have this powerful fleet that could challenge the British, and it has to do with the whole deterrent that Tirpitz attempted to do and failed at. So hence the smaller guns, smaller size for many of the warships, and there's a couple other things. So the Kyle Canal wasn't wide enough, and keel, and the some of the docks had to be enlarged, but well, you were there, Mark, the game design thing. Well, you too, Jeff. One of the things that struck me about that, and you guys spent some time talking about games have to have some price input. In other words, you can't have something that's so expensive that no one's going to buy it. I mean, you and the $500 game, for example. Yeah. But what I always felt, and I always tried to do with quarterdeck, and which may be one of the reasons I went out of business, is that I wanted to have not the art fits the box, but the box and the components fit the art. Okay? Does that make sense? In other words,
for example, Fleet Admiral, we might have to go to 6 map sheets. I don't think we will, but let's say we had to go for 6 map sheets. Well, then we might have to make the bookcase format bigger for 2 extra maps instead of 4 or 6. To me, you make the box bigger. You know, now it may make sense for other reasons to not go to 6 maps, but that was something what Tirpitz was thinking. Now, it was Kaiser, of all people, and some of his admirals, often the admirals went into disfavor and were then shown to the door by Tirpitz and Fire, who wanted to build fewer but more expensive fast battleships, possibly in smaller quantities, that might have lessened British interest in joining a war against Germany. And I would argue that some of what we saw the Germans build running up to World War II was taking that concept and running with it. And we're going to build certainly ships with longer range, because that was one of the problems with the German battleships and battlecruisers in World War I, is that they had short legs. And the fact that they were newer than, say, the Resolution class at the beginning of World War II, I mean, that gave them an advantage no matter, you know, what they were facing. But it might have lessened Britain's interest in joining the war against Germany. Now, Admiral Wolfgang Wegener, is probably the best known anti-Tirpitz admiral. And he was the one, and we actually discussed a little bit of this in the Norway discussion, advocated the control of the French coast, the islands off Norway, like Faroe or even Iceland, as well as Norway and Denmark. And this was to break the British stranglehold on the German North Sea. The fact that the North Sea is crowded in there, and Britain and Scotland lie across it, and you have the narrow channel to get out, and you have to force your way up around the north end of Scotland, that this would be the way to get around it. In fact, he wrote in 1927, and I'll butcher this German, but it's Reiter ohne Ross, a rider without a horse, and that's what he considered the German Navy. They didn't have a proper strategic view. And Rader didn't embrace Wegener, but in a lot of ways, the capture of Denmark and Norway was a justification,
Vindication,
fair enough, vindication of Wegener's thinking. Now, having said all this, Tirpitz, of course, was aided in the excellent underwater protection, the quality armor, and the quality guns, as well as the training. In addition, now here's something that blew me away. German ship pumps were a magnitude higher in power and number than on British warships. So it wasn't like they were like 10% better. These things were like there were more of them, and they were just qualitatively could pump a lot more water. Well, why do you think the couple of those crippled German battlecruisers got back to port after the Battle of Jutlands? Because of those pumps. The Marlborough almost sank with one torpedo hit. We talked a little about range. The Mackensen class of battlecruisers, which were in the design stage at the end of World War I, they had increased their range from 4,000 nautical miles to almost 8,000 nautical miles, almost a doubling of the range. So the Germans at the end of World War I kind of had an inkling of what they needed to do. The Glorious and Courageous, are any of you guys familiar with the large cruisers? Okay.
Outrageous class.
Fair enough. They were the fruit of Fisher's fevered brain, where it would be 33 knots, 4 15-inch guns that could crush any German light cruiser. Well, Fisher wanted to give them oil at a range of 11,000 miles. Now, they ended up by the 1917, 1918, when they were completed, having a range of 8,000 miles. But that kind of gives you a sense of the difference between where the Germans and the British were operating. Okay, well, we'll finish up here. One of the most interesting comments by Moltke the Younger, who commanded the German army at the beginning of the war, on the eve of the war, he expected a big naval battle in which the Germans would lose and the USA would come to be the dominating naval power. Well, there was no grand battle, but Germany and Britain were beggared from the long war, and, of course, the United States Navy is now the supreme navy on the planet. The other thing is, a lot of the German World War I naval officers also saw that the war is the first Punic War, that this was a replay between Rome and Carthage. I assume that they saw themselves as... I don't know. I have
Carthage.
Against
the Empire.
But There was that. And then one of the things, too, that I found when I was researching so far was the communication between German ships, especially at the time of Jutland, and especially at night, was superior to the British. So they were able to note British recognition lights and share that to the other German ships in their fleet better than the British. And the intelligence crew that the British had in being able to rapidly read German wireless messages was not properly exploited until after Jutland. I don't know if you've heard the story, but the intelligence department, room 40, for the British Navy, which was reading the German mail, they were academics and they weren't naval officers. And the admiral who was in charge of
Winterhall.
This is Jackson.
Okay.
He came into the meeting room and he asked, "Have you heard where the signal for the German flagship is?" And one of the guys said, "That's Wilhelmshaven, the German naval base." And that's all he said, didn't ask any explanation. Well, if he'd asked an explanation, they would have said, "But we now know that the Germans, they do this when their fleet goes to sea, they have and he did, and that was one of the things that changed after the battles, that they realized that they had this intelligence coup and they misused the information. We never heard that being done before, right? And here's another thing that came up from all this. And so you go and you look at Jane's fighting ships, or you go and look at the Conway's, and you see the torpedoes have a range on the... In 1914, they have a new German torpedo, actually going to Campbell or Friedman now. And you say, "Well, shoot, this torpedo can go 11,000 yards, and it's got a speed of 35 or 40 knots. Well, guess what? You don't just click your fingers and get all those new torpedoes on all your ships. What happened is the battlecruiser, German battlecruiser scouting force, they had the new torpedoes, and the Germans were really big on having their best torpedoes and having torpedo outfits on their dreadnoughts. So they would put their best stuff on that. But if you're talking about the Rostock, who's back with the main fleet and is kind of out on it, it's got lousy torpedoes, okay? And that's another thing we miss. We just assume that's going to be best. Now, there's no way I know how I'm going to be able to research what ships have what, but I'm going to get it in there.
Do you have a copy or access to World War? There's a book out there, World War One Weapons, Guns.
Yeah, it's Friedman.
Okay.
Yeah, Friedman's book came out, and it's pretty good. There's a couple, there's going to be mistakes in anything that's that detailed.
That's Friedman,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
F-R-I. Yeah, Norman Friedman. He's done a billion books on naval stuff.
Two E's or an I-E?
I-E.
It's still in print.
It's still fairly new.
A year ago.
This is funny too. So Fisher, as early as October 15, 1914, he returned to the Admiralty. He wanted to place as many mines and wire entangles hanging around to disrupt the German U-boats, which were becoming a menace. Well, the Navy wasn't ready anywhere near with a number of mines that were required. And guess what? British quality of their mines was poor, so they captured a German mine and they adopted it for their service. And they manufactured those by the thousands. To finish up here, Admiral Pohl, who commanded the High Seas Fleet just before Scheer took over, and he was dying from cancer, he endorsed Admiral Wegener's views that they needed to take over Denmark at a minimum. And another officer at the same time was summing up, "To add to our position, we need Antwerp, Helgoland Bight, which they had, Kristiansand, which is in the south side of Norway, the Vestfjord, which is Narvik, the Faroes, Constantinople, the Azores, and the Cape Verde Islands." and the Cameroons, East Africa, and East Africa. Of course, some of this they had. Anyway, that's pretty much it. We can certainly discuss things.
On your torpedoes and all that, we're doing literally an alternate scenario for our across the Pacific. And when the Dutch Navy in the Dutch East Indies demobilized at the end of World War II, some of the torpedoes they had gotten from the United States had been manufactured for coastal defense in World War I and had been sent on to the
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting about the Dutch Navy is that they were the first Navy that I believe was the first Navy to adopt the snorkel. So they were actually using the snorkel in the 30s.
Yeah.
And I think the Germans didn't get to it until, what, 44?
43.
I think Americans still were using first, but that was way early. It was not operational.
But it wasn't adopted.
Yeah.
Jack, so the German Navy, Tirpitz, who's in charge of this, has a fleet where he has designed it to fight at 8,000 yards, right? Basically.
Right.
And the range of the North Sea is usually 8,000 yards. But they choose to go out in May and June when it's double the range in the North Sea. Why? Why not do it when the range is
gone?
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
You get into the whole political situation. At the beginning of the war, the Kaiser didn't want to lose any of his valuable ships, and he did suffer the defeat at the Battle of Helgoland, where British battle cruisers came in and banged up and sank a couple of three old German light cruisers. And of course, you know, you have to send the obituaries out to all the local newspapers and stuff. You know, Hans is dead, and, you know, he got killed by the British. And it just made the Kaiser even more conservative in utilizing the fleet. And it was compounded by the fact that, hey, the war's going to be over by, you know, when the leaves fall, right? Certainly by Christmas. So why risk the fleet? And Hitler had a little bit of the same problem, where probably any leader does. When you lose an expensive asset, which a naval ship or a dreadnought especially represents to the nation, it looks bad in the newspapers. And the Kaiser was in love with the Navy. That was, you know, one of his main passions. So politically, they went through that, then they went through the U-boat war, the first phase of the U-boat war. Then they decided, well, okay, we're going to stop the U-boat war. Let's use the high seas fleet. And Scheer had come in because Poland died from cancer. And Scheer at least went out and tried to do some operations. And they thought they had some advantages. They were going to use the Zeppelins. Well, the Zeppelins were not that effective in North Sea reconnaissance. And they were hoping to catch, you know, a chunk of the British Navy, not the whole tiger. So, clearly they got pounded. The Germans got pounded in the late afternoon, early evening before the sun failed at the Battle of Jutland. And for starts, the sun was setting behind them, so they were illuminated, and they couldn't even see the British, who could see them.
I think my regular recall reading somewhere that the Germans had finally figured out what had happened at Dogger Bank and decided on that basis that they had a chance that they sent the whole high seas to nail the portion of the British. They realized after Dogger Bank that the British had sent a small enough portion of their fleet out, basically the battle cruisers and one battleship.
It's actually an earlier one. What you're thinking of is, I think it's the Scarborough raid.
Okay,
it's one of the early ones, and what had happened is that they sent this. In fact, it's going to be a scenario. The British sent out their best battle ships, 13.5-inch guns. Probably eight of them. And Ingenall, who was the first German admiral, and this is why he got relieved of command in large part. And he zigged when he should have zagged. So he went back to port when you hear, oh, the British are out, we better run back to port, and you know, Kaiser will be mad. And if they had gotten into an action, they would have been perfect. They would have outnumbered the British, and the British battlecruiser squadron would probably have been hauled into it, and the whole German fleet was basically there. And it was the thing that they had always hoped and dreamed for.
Right, I mean, the Germans figured this out after the fact, that they had, in fact, gotten the British in that position, and so I don't believe it, that Jutland, they were trying for that again. Mm-hmm. And they just simply did not expect to run into the whole high seas, or the whole grand fleet.
The certificate that's a partly cool is that the shell holes from the World War I shelling are still there, and it's Keith Poulter's hometown.
Is it really?
Oh,
Jack, on the evaluation, the analysis book, where he counts every shell he had,
right?
And he also says where they came from.
Yeah.
Does this data support what you were saying. In other words, that's one of the things that you were able to
do. They weren't penetrating the armor, but if you got hit enough times, you...
No, but I'm talking about what ships were able to hit. In other words, what you're saying is that
order
to hit the enemy, you're saying there is a major jump between these ships, not just a small jump. So for the sake of argument, let's say this one version, this 12-incher is a 1. Okay, mm-hmm. That's its firepower. The Lion is a 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just reading into this.
No,
and then the Queen Mary is a 6 or 7. Okay, so you can tell when you look at those numbers that, holy cow, you know, the Queen Mary is vastly better than the Dreadnought.
A couple of examples. The Queen Mary, which had the Poland system on board, they, to the best of my knowledge, they don't think it did that much better. Okay, and the Brooks book says the Poland system was not that much better than the Dreyer system.
Okay,
that's a
Campbell's book supports what you just said by showing the Queen Mary did not hit that much.
The Agincourt, which had the biggest number of guns on the broadside, I don't think it could bring all 14 guns to bear. I think there was two wing turrets, but I
there was a concern that if they fired all at once, it caps up.
It scored 0 hits.
0.
And it was the one that did not have the fire control on board. Now, it's also from the rear of the line.
How many rounds did it fire?
It wasn't in action that long.
It fired 7 full broadsides. That was it. But 7 full broadsides and all 14 guns. They took a chance. Hey, this is our one chance to hit the German. This isn't a very good match. Let's try it and see what happens. It got off 7 full broadsides. They all missed, and that was the end of that result.
And the Germans, who were pounding the British, who were pounding the front of the German van, the best German battleships, as well as the battle cruisers. Those were primarily the better and newer British battleships. So, Jellicoe had put his best battleships in the van. And
part of this is positioning. It's not just simply the qualitative difference between the ships.
Yeah. Well, and it's just like the visibility issues. I mean, see, one thing you're going to have to do, and I did it in the old Fleet Admiral. I'll probably just retrofit it straight onto the new one. Is that as the battle's going on, there's all this friggin' coal smoke getting up in the sky. So your visibility, just from the human activity, which I know certain senators from Oklahoma would say humans have no impact on visibility, but the coal smoke is actually making the visibility decrease as the battle persists.
You know, for your information, the German van was composed of their newest ships.
Koenigs.
The British van was composed of newest ships. The Koenigs were actually doing 23.5 knots. They had a pretty good speed, so they were actually getting ahead of the rest of the Germans. And so when the Hood cut in with his battle cruisers to try and cut across the German T the way they were supposed to, this was his battle cruiser squad, battle cruiser division, which was with the Grand Fleet. They were taking on the Koenigs, and that did not turn out well.
Yeah, well, they were poorly armed.
Something wrong with our damn ships.
Go ahead.
I thought when I've read about the account of the battle that one of the problems the British had is that their armor on their battle cruisers wasn't too bad, but they had insufficient flash protection.
Exactly correct.
So then you can't just say, okay, this is armor of 4. It seems like if it hits the armor directly, it would be okay, but if it hits a turret.
Well, that's why you have special damage in Fleet Admiral. And as a class 4, you roll on that table and say, yes,
also, at the Outer Bank, the Sablets took a similar burnout hit, and that was a lot, took out every turret in that portion of the ship.
And the Germans learned from it.
And so in a sense, that was a little bit lucky.
So what I'm saying is,
British didn't get that.
Prior to Dover Bank, the German ships were as vulnerable to flash as the British. After Dover Bank,
no, they weren't. They were not because there's no recorded instance of a German warship in World War I, with the possible exception of the Karlsruhe, of blowing up from
Sailors didn't only because the heroism of one.
No ship blew up except for the Karlsruhe, and the Germans. I mean, and the British lost several. And the other thing is that there was a bunch of old powder.
That was the other thing.
Oh, yeah.
The British were going around and like, geez, we've got some of this powder left over from the turn of the century.
From the Crimean War, yeah.
Yeah, if someone wanted to incorporate naval activity in a World War One game that had a more, say, strategic scope.
Oh, like an area movement game?
Or even a small folio game, yeah, or whatever. If you wanted to introduce a naval aspect in a higher level or of what Mark Herman calls granularity, how would you go about incorporating these insights?
I put it in something that's maybe
called. Or is that question, you know, like, yeah, beyond the scope of this seminar?
Oh, well, no, maybe cards. In fact, I was going to talk a little bit about some of the differences. The original fleet admiral was 1,500 yards to a hex because somewhere along the line I had figured out that two dreadnoughts sitting on top of each other in one hex would be 1,500 yards. And so I'm rereading Martyr, and what do I find? Is that he gives this figure. The Jellicoe's got the battle fleet tight. They're tight in line. There isn't any straggling because of the different speeds that the Germans were traveling at. And it turns out that if you take the, I think it's 24 or 26 battleships, and you look how long the line was, it was like, you know, 4 miles or something, it works out to it's 11,000 yards for two battleships. So my scale in the original fleet admiral was wrong. And what I did is I already said there's going to be a fudge factor. I'm not going to have people calculating 11,000 yards, 22,000 yards, 33,000 yards. Let me just make 1,000 and be done with it. You know, that way it works.
You're close enough for government work.
Exactly. And so, and then, like, let's say, make the Benbow, instead of having +1 because it's nationality, -2 for this, fire director is shitty, we'll make it another -1. No, you just give it a combat factor of 6. And that's what its broadside is, for argument's sake. And then the Queen of the Bellerophon will say, and then the Queen Elizabeth will just give it a combat factor of 12. You know, and that there's no pluses or minuses. And the same thing came up with the night action. The Germans were much, much better at night actions. The British didn't. It took the interwar period for the British to learn how to fight the night for their heavy ships. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about it, and I go, well, how do I want to deal with this? Do I want to start killing pluses and minuses? It dawned on me. And Krantz said, no, not wrong. Do it, Jack. There's two CRTs. You have a CRT for the British for night combat, and you have a CRT for night combat for the Germans. And basically, the Germans are going to be hitting the British a lot more at night because they have superior night fighting ability. And the Germans specifically trained for that.
Like the Japanese in the Pacific in World War II.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't know why the Germans got into that. Maybe because they were so often with their navy inferior for decades before the Kaiser came to power. I mean, you know, the French were stronger, the Russians were stronger, that they thought maybe they'd be fighting enough. Or the other thing I sometimes think, the Doderbank incident that took place in the end of 1904, the beginning of 1905, when the Russians came through and sank some English fishing trawlers at night because they thought they were Japanese torpedo boats that had come all the way around from Japan. Maybe there was like, oh, geez, maybe we should be better at night. But the Germans are clearly better. But there again, with a simple CRT, you don't have to do any pluses or minuses. You see what your gunfire factor is. You roll the dice. You don't have to make any pluses or minuses. Just one second. There's a brand new game out. And the guy was a real gentleman at WBC. I took a professor friend around. And he had this fellow game designer, who's Italian, he had a new game on the war in Europe, and GMT's coming out with it. And I'm looking at it, and I'm having the designer explain it to my friend, because my friend has never been to a game convention, never seen these things before. And what it is all the units are all generic. They're, it's a standard map of Europe, but we all see them. And there's a German unit here, and there's an Italian infantry unit here, and there's a British infantry unit here. There's no numbers on them. It just says that they're an infantry army. That's what they represent, an infantry army. What he's done is this entire CRT is that when you take that Italian unit and you put it next to a British unit, Well, you look under your table and you see that there's Italians, so you get a minus two to the die roll. And if it's German, oh, you get a plus two to the die roll. It's, in other words, instead of having a number, which I think would be much more sensible, that, you know, represents the combat value, he is having a poor player going up and down the entire game, plus and minus. And how many times have we played a game where three turns ago, oh my gosh, you know, I forgot that minus two against him when I blew your ship up, Dana. Dana, I'm sorry about that. That never happens. So anyway, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
No, I think it's the mentality of every, a lot of navies that are inferior. There's a nice book out there, it's called, Japanese, Imperial Japanese, or Japanese Destroyer Captain by Hara.
Yeah, Japanese Destroyer Captain.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, it was always the thing, we got to get better at what we can get better. If we don't have numbers, we got to do the math. Because his obsession was, you got to do something. They outnumber us 3-1. That means every battle, we better beat them 3-1.
Have you read P.D. or P.D. and Evans, Kaigen or Sunburst?
No, no.
That's what you want to read. Evans died, I think, and P.D. Just wrote the Sunburst. I could be wrong on that. But Kaigen, which is K-A-I-G-U-N, is an excellent discussion of the evolution of the Japanese Navy. It's a keeper. I'm destroying my library. I'm trying to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. That's one that my wife and my daughter are going to have to figure out what the hell they want to do.
Okay.
I'm keeping that one. And both of those. And Sunburst goes into their whole air doctrine. And if you're working on a war in the Pacific, and unless you know Japanese, you want those two books. So,
excellent.
Anything else? Mm-hmm.